everyone, and welcome back to episode 2 of Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, sponsored by California Soul Music, hosted by Cliff Beach. I am very, very excited today to have Mr. Mike Clark on air today. He's going to be talking about his Live at the Iridium album called Indigo Blue, featuring such great, great artists as Christian McBride and so many other great musicians. So excited to have him on all the way from New York to be on air. Please help me welcome Mr. Mike Clark.
Hello, Mike.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm dealing with it same as we all are, you know. Here in New York, maybe it's a little more severe than on the West Coast, but wherever everybody is, we're all trying not to get the virus, that's for sure.
So, definitely. Yeah, we never thought in a million years that something so small could be so impactful.
Yeah, so here we are. But I'm making the best out of it, that I don't feel bad or I'm not depressed or anything like that. I've actually created quite a few projects since this has happened. I've done an online clinic that paid very well, and then out of that I had 2 or 3 days of wall-to-wall students, which also was lucrative. And I produced a guy's, not an entire record, but 2 tracks for 2 different people, and all from my house, from the front room. So it's been pretty weird. But
okay.
I'm hanging. Yeah, it is. That was cool. I didn't even try. A guy called me up. I said, man, I don't even know how to do that. He goes, well, I'll help you. I'm like, well, okay. So I found some old tracks that I had, drum tracks, and I found them, several, and put them all at the same BPM. And then I had my friends who have recording studios or a way to record in their house, and that's what happened. And then I put it all together in my computer. It was pretty good.
Yeah, man. I mean, at least we're living in an age where we have the technology for that. I mean, if it was 100 years ago, we'd be in a different situation.
Where are you, bro? You're in 310, so you're in L.A., is that correct?
I am in L.A., yes, in West L.A., near Culver City, near the Sony Studio.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah.
But originally from the East Coast, I'm from Washington, D.C. area, and then I went to school at Berkeley in Boston before moving out to L.A.
Right. Well, I love L.A. I mean, I lived out there a little bit, and I like Culver City. I like that whole, I lived off of Pico and Robertson.
Oh, and, yeah, I'm not too far from there. I'm at National and Robertson, basically.
Oh, okay. And I'm a Buddhist, so there used to be a, and there still is a Friendship Center, right at, what's that street that goes, off of Pico, goes
Fairfax.
Right down to...
I think it's Fairfax.
It's Fairfax and Valencia,
uh-huh.
I believe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've been
by
that place many times.
Okay. Yeah, I used to... So, anyway, so here we are. We were able to do this, so this is very cool.
Yeah, that's interesting that you're a Buddhist, and Herbie Hancock's a Buddhist, too, so that's kind of in that same kind of school of thought.
Yeah, well, Herbie Hancock is the guy that got me chanting Nam Myoho Renge Kyo, and when I was a kid, when I was in his band, when I was quite young, and I stayed with it. I just got done chanting like a few minutes ago.
Well, if there's any time to chant, now would be the time for peace of mind,
yeah.
Connectivity, spirituality, of course.
Yeah, this is a good time to be chanting, bro.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, yeah, very excited to have you on today and just get to talk to you. Of course, you know, I've been a longtime fan, and we've been actually kind of corresponding since I reached out to you first a few years ago. But I'm glad that you wanted to talk about some of your newer stuff and some of the acoustic stuff. I really dug into this weekend your Indigo Blue album, and I was just not aware of how amazing that album was, and I listened to it a few different times, and every time I listen to it, I get a different experience. But yeah, very excited
nice.
To talk about it.
Oh, great. Well, sure. Ask away, whatever. I got a bunch of other stuff going on, too, we'll get to, but go ahead. Whatever
awesome.
Questions that you have, I'm ready.
Great.
So
yeah, on one of your latest releases, the Indigo Blue Live at the Iridium, This is a departure from what Jazz Times says is your militaristic snare drum playing and inside-out grooves that you're known for and your funk and jazz fusion origins to an all-acoustic, straight-ahead jazz sound. All About Jazz gave me further backstory saying that the record comes from a series of concerts that took place near the end of 2018 and was released on 2019 on High Note Records, and it's a reimagining of one of your well-received Blueprints of Jazz Volume 1 albums back in 2010 on Talking House Records, and McBride and Harrison were featured on this recording as well as those initial set dates in 2010. How did this album kind of come to be? How did you pick the venue? How did you pick the songs? How did you pick the personnel?
Well, let's see. I've made a lot of jazz albums, acoustic. That's my real thing. Mm-hmm. That's my passion, and it has been since high school. So I've made quite a few post-bop records.
Okay.
And but the records that I made with Herbie Hancock sold so many records that more people know me from that, because the jazz records don't sell like those funk records did in the 70s. So those sold a million. So, you know, and I know Patrice for a long time. I know Kristen McBride used to live in my building off of 3rd Avenue in New York. And we'd see each other. And we'd always say, hey, man, let's get together and play. So I had this record deal out in California in San Francisco. And they said, well, who would you like? We can afford these people, so who would you like? I said, well, I definitely want to play with Christian because I know he's got a great beat and he's also got vision. And I wanted to play with Patrice because her and I had been kind of saying, someday we got to get together and not play funk and play jazz, because anything that I would do in L.A. with her, the few things that I did were always, there was a business behind it that demanded we play funk, you know. So I knew this was a jazz date because it was my date, so I called her. And I called a great New York tenor player, Jed Levy, and he arranged a lot of the stuff. And then I called Donald Harrison, who's one of my favorite artist, and I play a lot with him, a lot of traveling the world together, and about 20-25 years of concerts, jazz clubs, funk gigs, headhunters. He's one of the main guys in the headhunters whenever we do that, but we also do a lot of jazz gigs together, all kinds of stuff. We'll just end up on a lot of gigs together year after year, so I understand his music instinctively, and he does mine. So he was a must because he can cover everything from Charlie Parker to Wayne Train, Junior Walker, and he's got his own New Orleans stuff. And he's also a big chief of the Black Indian tribe, the Congo Nation.
Oh, wow.
And he brings rhythm. Yeah, he brings rhythms and chants from that experience. And so it's great. And so the music is born from all of those different people and those experiences. And so that's what happened there. And then I made a few other records, jazz records with different people. And then I went back in this last time and made Indigo Blue. And I brought in Rob Dixon from Indianapolis, a great tenor player. And I brought Donald, Randy Brecker on trumpet, and Antonio Faro, a tremendous Italian piano player from Italy. And we wrote the charts, and we all agreed on what we're going to do, and we went in and did it, and I really dig the record. The record really got rave reviews, and everybody loved it. And so that worked. And now I'm sitting on, I just finished a record with Leon Dorsey and Michael Wolfe of Beatle tunes, but no electric, you know, it's all straight ahead swing. And it's probably coming out in a couple of months.
Wow, that's great.
And oh, it's great. It's really great. It's like in the pocket, swinging, acoustic. So we played Beatle songs, but we played them jazz style. And so we're excited. And then, Leon and I also did a trio with the great piano player from Memphis, Harold, I can't think of his last name. I'm having a senior moment here.
All right.
Yeah, I'll tell you in a minute. But he's a tremendous player, and he brings, like, he's from Memphis, and he brings that whole tradition. Harold Mabrum, and he does all the Memphis stuff, Phineas, all of that stuff. So he also played a lot of blues in Memphis. So he brings this really incredible jazz and blues. It's his life. He just brings it with him where it goes, you know. And he's an amazing player. He passed away, so this very well could be his last recording. So I think these recordings are going to be out. Maybe the one with Michael Wolff will come out in June or July, and then we're looking by August, September for the one with Harold Mayburn. So that's what we're doing. And then we have another one. Yeah, we have another one in a can with Manny Valera, a great jazz and Latin jazz and jazz musician. So we're doing all of this stuff. We've been doing all this stuff, and now we're going to have it realized. We're going to bring it out. So we're doing the business on it. We're picking the tunes and the orders and editing and doing what we have to do. And we're doing a lot of it today. So that's kind of what I'm doing. Yeah, that's
kind of
what
I'm doing. Keep it up.
Oh, yeah. And then I'm in Eddie Henderson's band, and we've done a lot this last year. We've done a lot of concerts, and we've done a lot of club work. And we have a record coming out in September on Smoke label. Paul Stash is putting it out. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Excited to hear that. That's going to be great.
Yeah, that's really going to be great. We had one out last year, too. And now the one last year was entitled Be Cool. And I don't know what the title of this one is, but this one was Kenny Barron, Donald Harrison, Eddie Henderson, myself. And
I mean, that's a real tour de force to have so much content, so many albums in the can and pushing those out. I mean, how do you keep them all straight and decide what you're going to record? And then what's the difference between recording a live date like the Indigo Blue versus your in-studio stuff? Like, how do you approach them differently?
Well, I have relationships with these people, and so we kind of have bands together. We don't work as much as we used to in these different bands. So, but we all know each other fairly well, and we know our playing. So, like I was going to say, on Eddie Henderson's record, you have Gerald Cannon playing bass, who's a friend of mine, and him and I got a nice lock. You know, we could really have a nice swing together, good feel. It seems to be, before this virus hit, there seemed to be enough time for me to do all of these projects, and it didn't seem to be a problem. You do maybe two a week. They're all good record dates. You learn them. There's a rehearsal. You learn the stuff, and then you guys get to, it's always fun. The guys are great people, too, as well as high-level musicians, and we get into it. You know, it's a joy, you know.
So, yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, that's the only reason to do it. And it's nice to have, you know, just friends and people you respect and love coming together just to have fun. And you can definitely hear that on the record for sure. So then how do you approach it being a band leader? You're a band leader on a lot of the albums. You're also a sideman on some of the albums. Comedian Paul F. Tompkins on jazz often jokes, it's not about what I play. It's about what I don't play, dummy. Is that true in your drumming style and your technique as well? Like, you know, knowing when to play and when not to play and that conversation you're having between the players?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm to the point now when people call me to do something, they have an idea, a pretty good idea of what I do, or they've had enough experience playing with me that I know I'm going to bring the stuff that I bring to the gig. And if they want that, then that's why they're calling me. So I'm figuring that's going to be okay. But the degree to which I'm going to do that depends on them. If I'm not the leader, then if they want to play a little more mellow or hold things back, I'm fine with that. Or if they just want to swing, one arm swing, and just have a groove, not too much activity, I'm good with that. But also if they want it to be like a lot of communication and a lot of fireworks. Well, that's what I'm really good at. That's my range, you know, and I can cover also time periods. Like I can play bebop, or I can make it sound modern, and I can do one and make it sound like I don't know about the other. So I have that width of people to draw from that will hire me. And when it's my vision, it's different because I'm not worried about what I'm going to do or what I'm not going to do. That would be my choice because I'm the guy that's paying everybody. But when I'm working for something else, I don't try to make my vision their vision. I try to help them realize their vision. You know, I think it's a good people thing to do that. And I'm good at doing it, and I enjoy doing that. I enjoy doing that, you know. So most of the stuff I do is pretty cool, meaning there's not a lot of neurosis. There's not a lot of things to figure out. It's pretty straightforward, the reason that I've been called, if I'm being called as an aside man. So the music usually plays itself.
That's very well said. I mean, that makes sense. And you would have to be that versatile to have such a long career and have played on so many different types of records and different styles. And that's definitely evident in your entire catalog. So let's talk about a little bit about your origin story. So I'm told that you were born in Sacramento, California, and then you traveled around with your father, who was a drummer as well. And you're actually a prodigy, starting drumming at age 4 and sitting in house bands in Texas and New Orleans. And then by your early 20s, you're known as one of the founders of the distinctive East Bay sound coming out of Oakland, like great bands like Tower Power. So what was it like traveling with your dad and playing so young and kind of pioneering that early sound and then kind of taking you into where you are now?
Well, it was really exciting for one thing, because he seemed to know where all the great jazz clubs were, whatever town we were in. He would travel, being a railroad man, and he'd take me with him in the summertime. And if there was a break for me at school at Thanksgiving or Christmas or this or that, he would arrange to target an area where there was a festival or a lot of nightclubs featuring jazz. And he would then he would take me into these clubs, and he'd introduce himself to the band leader, and he'd maybe buy the drummer a drink or say, "Hey man, if I give you guys $50, will you let my kid play?" I was 7 or 8 years old. And we went out every night and did this 2 or 3 times a night. And some of the bands then started to recognize us and say, "Hey, you don't have to give us any money. Let him play. He's a good drummer. Come on up and play." So I started learning that way. And it was very exciting because it was a different culture. It was a different town. It was a different way of playing. A lot of the playing is, and the dialect is geographical as well, you know. Like if you play in Atlanta, it's going to sound different than if you play in New Orleans. It's regional, you know, and especially I spent time in Texas, so I definitely developed quite a bit of stuff for Texas playing. So by the time I was in high school, I was an experienced drummer that was used to being paid for working, you know. And I had already had quite a few gigs with well-known people, Tex Beneke and Vito Musso. These guys were from the big band era. I started developing a taste for modern jazz, bebop. I was now buying Art Blakey and records and records with Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie, and I was digesting all this stuff, and there were young people around my age, and I would find people who were into this type of music, and then I would join them and become one of them, and then we would all start playing together and trying to develop. It was great, and I got to do it all over the United States because my dad traveled. And then once I graduated from high school, I went on the road immediately and made a good living on the road. And Vince Guaraldi hired me, the piano player, mm-hmm. and And he was a Wynton Kelly type piano player. He could really swing. And we traveled all over the place. And then we did a couple of those Peanuts things, which were kind of musically silly. But that was the bread and butter. But he was actually a Wynton Kelly kind of guy. That's how we played on the gigs, you know. And I enjoyed playing with Vince a lot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you've played with so many people throughout your career. It's a long list of amazing jazz titans, for sure, including Vince. Your origins, you range from funk with keyboardist Herbie Hancock to your stuff with the Headhunters and also working with Betty Davis and also doing propulsive jazz fusion with the British group Brand X. So how was that kind of 70s period for you?
Well, it was amazing because, Paul, I had an organ trio, a jazz organ trio, in a club called The Village in Vallejo, California. And I knew that Freddie Stone, Sly Stone's brother, lived in Vallejo. I knew some of the guys from around there. But this was the organ, guitar, and drums. And we played standard tunes and Jimmy Smith-type things. That's what we did. And I had that gig for 3 or 4 years, 4 nights a week. And musicians were coming in from all over the place. And so one night, Paul Jackson walked in. I didn't know who he was, and he sat out there staring at me all the time I was playing. I'm like, okay, this guy likes my drumming, or he's interested, so he's got to play something, and I'm pretty sure he plays bass. I can tell, you know, he just had that bass player look, big guy, you know, like Indian. Yeah, so he came up and played organ, B3, and sang a tune, and he rocked the whole house. It was marvelous. And I said, man, this guy's wonderful. And I knew he played upright bass. So that night, I got it before he left. I got his business card. But when I got home that night, he was in my driveway with hashish and wine at 2 o'clock in the morning. And he said, hey, man, look what I got here. Can I come in? I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, come on in. So we became like best friends that night. We hung out all night. And then he worked at Sherman and Clay Music in Broadway in Oakland. And he went to the warehouse and pushed out a B3 organ and put it in my music room, in my front room, and left it there for a year or two. And then he brought a couple of electric basses and a couple of amps. But meanwhile, he's playing acoustic bass, upright. And we're doing these jazz things with a local guy named Al Tanner, a good piano player. Well, pretty soon we're working all the time. And then Paul gets a call to play some Black Panther. They're going to do speeches out on 14th Street. And the Black Panthers are going to have rallies, and they want to hire Paul. And so we have the B3 in my front room, and we have a truck. They put a generator on the truck for electricity, and I play drums. So we're playing the Panther rallies, and it's fun. And we're making up music for these rallies, right? We're making up this real funky music for these rallies. Neck bones, hog head cheese. Mama, that's where I'm coming from. You know, real funky stuff. And the crowd loves us. So we do a bunch of these on East 14th Street when they're having the trucks bring meat to the people and all this kind of stuff. And so it's an amazing time. So through that activity, some other musicians, and we got popular, and then after we started doing nightclubs as a duo, just Paul and I, organ and sing, and then if we had another guy, well, then Paul could play bass, but it's still upright bass. So then one day he switches to the electric bass, and he plays it exactly the way he plays it with Herbie Hancock, a very busy bass line. He takes it out of the case. He's never really played it before, and he plays it like that. He played it like a guitar. And the first thing I said, look, Brad, if you're going to play bass like that, we need to hire a bass player. Because there ain't nobody playing bass. He was playing every 16th note there was. And he's like, no, man, play that funky thing you play. So we started to play these bass lines and funk grooves together. And they immediately went together. We didn't even have to discuss tempo or anything. It was just, we just understood each other. And then when Herbie heard that, he hired us both, to make a long story short. And the first year or two, we were operating like that. We were doing these bass lines and drum parts underneath Herbie. And we play Actual Proof and the Watermelon Man. And we play it Oakland style. And he loved it. And it was very creative and new. And the people were all excited. And we had huge audiences. But then it started to get commercial. And they were asking me to just play the straight 2 and 4 and not. I was too young to play straight. I wanted to make a name. I wanted to play my stuff. So I was no longer going to be the right guy for the headhunter. So I bailed and I went and joined Eddie Henderson's band in San Francisco at Jazz Gig. And in the band was Pharoah Sanders would play sometimes, and Joe Henderson. Dave Liebman, this was a great band, Mark Levine and Julian Priester. And we played for 11 months, 5 nights a week. We had a jazz gig. Man, that's when you really learn to play this stuff, you know. And so I stayed there with Eddie, and we had known each other for quite a while and were very dear friends. And then I moved back. When that gig stopped, I moved to New York. I knew I couldn't stay out on the West Coast anymore because I had to have that New York thing, and the way they play back here is different. And I fit in back here. I'm not laid back, so I, you know, and you can play with a lot of fire back here, and people understand it. And I ran into Eddie again back here when he moved back here, and we started playing together again. And meanwhile, I played with a million guys in New York, you know. Jack Wilkins, a great guitar player. I played with Donald Harrison, you know, Nicholas Payton occasionally. I played some with Wallace Roney. I can't even name them all because my phone was ringing from all these different people. So this is my life. You know, this is what I love.
Yeah, and, I mean, if we did try to name some, I mean, you played with Herbie, you played with Christian McBride, you played with Chet Baker, you played with John Scofield, Tony Bennett, Wayne Shorter, Joe Henderson, Vince Guaraldi, Albert King, Dr. Lonnie Smith, Bobby McFerrin, Gil Evans, and so many more. Jack, we actually had on earlier and talked to him in the previous episode. Who is your favorite instrumentalist and who's your favorite vocalist that you've worked with?
Well, that's a good question. My favorite vocalist. Wow, that's a fantastic question. Well, I would have to say Sarah Vaughan. I'd have to say, after all said and done, I have to say Sarah Vaughan. I love Billy and I love Dinah. I love Dinah too. But I guess I'd have to roll with Sarah.
She's definitely in the top three of jazz female vocalists, with Billy and Ella. Sarah will certainly hold her own, so I can see that for sure.
Yeah, I listen to all of those people and Nancy a lot. I mean, like,
of course.
Yeah, I do. It's pretty hard to pick. I pick Sarah because she's such a good musician, but then I'm thinking about Dinah. I just heard her. She was on the other morning. I had her playing Nobody Knows How I Feel This Morning. I mean, you can't get any more funky than that, man.
Right. You know? Yeah.
God. Holy cow. So, yeah, you know, it's hard to really choose one of those guys. That's like choosing between Miles and Train.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah, you can't do it. You know what I mean? Like,
and you don't have to. That's the beauty of it. You know, it's not an if or then. It's both. Why can't I have both? My cake and eat it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite album from your stuff, like as a band leader and as a sideman?
I think that as a band leader, the last Indigo Blue would have to be it for me. I really like that. I like Blueprints of Jazz also. That was good. I did another one called Summertime that I like. It's got some different stuff on it. I used Ricky Ford, I believe, was on it, and Jack Walrath, and Chip Jackson, Neil Kirkwood, and Jack Wilkins. But I like those. And as a sideman, I like the last Eddie Henderson record, Be Cool. I think that's killing, you know. I also produced a record for a spoken word guy named Tony Adamo. I produced three records, and I used Lenny White and all kinds of great horn players and musicians. And those records, if you go to Tony Adamo, A-D-A-M-O, they're on there, and he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, well, definitely check that out. I haven't heard those, but I'm sure they're just as amazing as your full body of work.
Thank you for listening once again to Deeper Grooves, Musicians on Music, hosted by Cliff Beach, sponsored by California Soul Music. We would like to take time to thank our guest, Mike Clark, for sharing his experience with us, as well as our engineer, Tim Hall, and 1192 Studios for mixing and mastering this recording. If you like this recording and you want to hear more, you can visit us on the web at www.californiasoulmusic.com/deepergrooves. Until then, take care and talk to you soon.